Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hi, Brian Lehrer here. Up next, Brian Lehrer Weekend. Three of our favorite segments from the week packaged together for you to listen to on the weekend. So enjoy, and I'll see you back on the radio Monday at 10 a.m. on WNYC and WNYC.org. It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. Scenario number one. Let's say you're a gay person in Kenya, where homosexuality is against the law, and President Obama is supposed to come to your country and give a speech.
That was the most tense in our life. Like, we were so worried before Obama came.
That's John Matenge, director of an HIV-oriented health clinic in Nairobi, in an NPR All Things Considered piece yesterday. He was worried that an Obama speech promoting gay rights could cause a backlash that might actually make things worse, not better. It's a dilemma. Do you want Obama to come and say something or just stay away? Scenario number two, even more intense. You're a gay person in Uganda, and the government is considering a law that would require doctors to turn you into the police when you go for health care. The U.S. helps to fund those health clinics and could threaten to cut them off. If the U.S. stays quiet, the hateful law takes effect without using our influence to try to stop it. If the U.S. threatens to cut off the funding, the backlash against LGBT Ugandans could get worse, including more belief in the conspiracy theory that homosexuality is a neo-colonial plot. You could wind up like this Ugandan activist, Julian Omzima, being beaten in prison.
They're like, okay, let's see how your American money is going to get you out of this today. It's definitely connected to the perceptions that they have about us, that we have money, that the West has given us money, and that, you know, the West is protecting us.
Julian Onzima, also on yesterday's All Things Considered. Let's play out these Kenya and Uganda scenarios now with NPR East Africa correspondent Gregory Warner, who reported that story. It's part of the NPR series A Nation Engaged, and we'll talk broadly today about how and when the U.S. should be a nation engaged in other countries' affairs. Hey, Gregory, welcome to WNYC. Nice to see you in New York.
Thank you, Brian.
And we'll open up the phones in this first part of the segment for any Kenyan-American or Ugandan-American listeners who are with us today. Kenyan-Americans, Ugandan-Americans, you out there? Call in and tell us what you think the U.S. should do in scenarios like those. 212-433-WNYC. We'll broaden it later to a wider caller invitation. But for now, if we have Kenyan or Ugandan listeners today, call in and tell everyone else about your views. Should the U.S. butt in, butt out? Does U.S. influence help with human rights, hurt with human rights? Or maybe you're a Kenyan or Ugandan who opposes LGBT rights. You're invited to 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. I wonder if you're out there today. Gregory, can you frame the dilemma for us more fully? What are you getting at in this story?
Sure. I mean, when I've been in Kenya for now 3-4 years, LGBT activism is a big part of the U.S. Engagement in Kenya and in Africa. It's been a big part of Obama's second term. But on the other hand, there's a rise in anti-gay activism on the African continent. And it's especially a growing front for a new movement in not just sodomy, anti-sodomy laws, but laws that are against what we might think of as living in a gay way, you know, living a gay open lifestyle where it includes everything from socializing, speaking openly, advocating, joining a pride parade, or doing a health drive. These kinds of things are now under attack. And what's been interesting to me to see is how, because of this and because of the American activism as well, homosexuality has taken on a kind of Western flavor, a sort of Western identity. And, you know, homosexuality is not new in Africa. In fact, pre-colonial, it's part of traditional societies, some traditional societies. A lot of the sodomy laws in Africa are colonial era laws. So this, the fact that now the anti-gay movement is seen as a pro-African, anti-Western movement, is deeply complicating for African activists who are then implicated and seen as kind of Western agents or Obama's agents.
So tell us what happened in the Uganda scenario where the doctors were maybe going to have to report patients who were homosexuals to the police.
Right. This is one of the most stringent laws that was on the books that's now been dropped, thanks, I think, to U.S. activism, and that's important to mention. But that's an example exactly of a kind of law where the landlord, if you rent a room to somebody who is gay or who hosts a gay event, or you're a doctor and you don't turn in somebody, you can be yourself convicted. There is a law, though, on the books now in Nigeria, the same-sex marriage prohibition law, it's even more strict than that. 10 years for attending a gay wedding, ten years for
just for attending a gay wedding,
or holding a conference, or speaking out, conceivably in favor of gay rights. And this is all about trying to silence people, trying to make people pariahs in their own country.
Listeners, I'm going to ask again because so far nobody's calling in. I think we have some Kenyan listeners right now, maybe fewer Ugandans.
Nigerians.
You want to expand the ask here?
I wonder if we can. We can.
Go ahead.
we can ask for Nigerian callers or
I know we have Nigerian listeners. So there are other African countries. The two examples in your story were Kenya and Uganda.
Sure.
But the same pattern is taking place elsewhere on the continent?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And it plays out in different ways. And we should also mention that in South Africa is legalized gay marriage. So it's been one of the on the forefront of gay rights. But throughout Africa, I think 34 out of the 54 countries outlaw sodomy. And so it's the majority.
So what did happen with respect to that Uganda law and the decision that you report that the United States was faced with, whether to threaten the withholding of funds to the health clinic?
So withholding funds is one of the most sort of sanctions is a very severe tool that we have in our diplomatic arsenal. And when it's done in favor of gay rights, there's always a risk that you might be attaching the money to this particular group. And that's a mixed blessing. So in Uganda, what happened was this law was passed. Now, this was a complicating factor because doctors were then supposed to report people. That was something that the U.S. did not want U.S. taxpayers to be paying for, hospitals that were actively not only discriminating but literally turning in people.
Yeah.
So that was an issue. But the Ugandan activists I spoke to were begging the United States, please be careful with the sanctions. Please be careful. Now, what ended up happening was kind of was interesting because on the one hand, those sanctions are largely credited for the killing of that law, which was briefly created. The bill was passed, it was made into a law. The president, Yoweri Museveni, organized the high court to invalidate the bill, and the law has not come forward since then. So the sanctions, in a way, worked. But the after effect was interesting because now the rhetoric is, the gays took away our money. You anointed people. So what happened to Pepe Julian Anziema, the guy you quoted, a transgender man, a Ugandan activist, is the last time he was arrested, and he's no stranger to being arrested. This was his fifth time. He was mocked by the police. They said, let's see your American money get you out of this one. And there was a feeling of extra hate because of his access to America, because of the fact that he has a U.S. diplomat's cell phone number on his phone. And when he went to prison and was beaten, threatened with rape, humiliated, he was saved, ironically, by his American access. The U.S. diplomats were able to dial in at 2 in the morning, rescue him from prison. And he says that mixed blessing of feeling both powerful and powerless at the same time, because of his status, his perceived privilege, he has more ability to get the ear of government, and yet at the same time he's more the object of envy and outrage.
So a mixed blessing of the U.S. being a nation engaged. Let's take a phone call. Carolyn in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Thank you so much for calling us.
Thank you for having me. I wanted to talk about John Mwenge and Kenya, because when Obama went there last year, the first thing I thought about when they were talking about the gay rights, I was very conscious of the fact that Kenyans had not accepted it. And even though, as my being bisexual here in and a Kenyan, I can be able to do that with freedom. But in Kenya, that is not going to happen. And I knew that there was going to be a backlash in terms of people being considered as being taking on American values. So I do agree with John Mazenge, and I do agree with the reporter talking about the fact that we should let it happen from the ground. After all, in America, it took about 30 or so years to happen.
Well, yeah, thanks for that call. I do think it is important to note, as you mentioned, that Kenya is, the people of Kenya are opposed to gay rights, and they've expressed that. But on the other hand, Kenya is not Uganda, and Kenya has laws in place to protect the health rights of gay men, for instance. So Kenya is definitely middle of the road, as it is for African countries. And so when Obama spoke, it was interesting to see that in the weeks before Obama's speech, that's when violence got the worst, because that gave license to Kenyan politicians to come and spew vitriol. I think credit is not...
And use it as a tool as well.
It was, what'd you say?
Use it as a tool.
And use it as a tool, exactly. And when the Kenyan president responded, I mean, you can, as you're mentioning, you can put yourself in his position, because here he is on a continent where anti-gay activism is associated with nationalism and pan-Africanism. And on the other hand, he's got this gauntlet thrown down by the American president, which he needs to answer, and he wants to be friends with America as well. So the response by the Kenyan president, Uhuru Kenyatta, was interesting. He said that in Kenya, gay rights is a non-issue. And many American commentators read that as, oh, a rebuttal to Obama, maybe even a rationalization of violence. Many Kenyan LGBT activists I spoke to said, no, that saved us. That was the... was sort of, don't pay attention here. Suddenly it was no longer patriotic to hate. A bill that was in parliament was killed. And he said, you know, that president really diffused a potentially volatile diplomatic conflict.
Carol, let's stay there for a sec, because we have those clips. In Kenya, in that speech last year, President Obama did refer to LGBT rights as part of a larger principle.
I believe in the principle of treating people equally under the law.
And then, as Gregory just described, Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta responded in this oblique way that may have been good or bad.
It's very difficult for us to be able to impose on people that which they themselves do not accept. For Kenyans today, the issue of gay rights is really a non-issue.
A non-issue. Carolyn, were you aware of that speech at the time, and how did you hear it?
Yes, I was aware of the speech, and I did listen to it. At the time, my first thought was, America had just gotten, the rights to have marriage for same-sex marriage. And I thought about it. I thought how many years it took for social change on the ground. And my first thought was, I was inclined to think that we cannot be able to impose social change on Kenyans on something that needs a social change over a long period of time, and acceptance, and seeing people, your brothers, your sisters, being lesbians, or, you know, somebody who you know.
But what does impose mean? Does it mean playing no role at all?
I feel like you cannot ask Kenyans to take on values that just happened, that were just accepted in this country the other day, that, you know, the social change came from the ground. It wasn't imposed upon them. There was no ruling that told them they had to change. It was a social movement from the ground up.
Thank you so much for your call, Carolyn. I really appreciate it. And here's Denise in Manhattan, a Ugandan-American. Denise, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for taking my call. My dad's Ugandan, and I spent some time in East Africa recently, and I observed that there were spaces in Tanzania, in Zanzibar and Dar es Salaam specifically, where the LGBTQ community could gather, but it was just very discreet, because even though it's not, I don't know that it's necessarily illegal in Tanzania, I'm not actually sure, it's definitely not accepted widely outside of kind of the expat and repat communities. In general, I'm a little wary of the U.S. government doing more than what President Obama has done in terms of making statements about human rights, just because sanctions against these countries hurt the people and, you know, do so much against the government. And I think that LGBTQ activists need, in Africa, need the space to kind of shape their own movements given the social context that they live in. And so I think really advocacy groups in the U.S. and in other places can, you know, support groups in Africa and across the continent. But these groups need to be able to shape what happens within their countries, because the country context is going to be different and the support within a country is going to be different.
What kind of support?
In the 54 countries that are in the continent.
What kind of support by U.S. advocacy groups do you think is useful for the local advocacy groups in a place like Uganda?
I think funding could be useful. I don't know, workshops and sharing resources on the type of advocacy that has been effective in the United States. There may be some things that can translate in terms of how to gather support or how to reach out to kind of see key stakeholders within government or within other kind of human rights groups. Coalition building. I think there's definitely space for coalition building.
And what kind of advocacy help do you think could backfire?
About support that that non-government actors in the U.S. could give. I think about how so much of the hate movement in Uganda and other places, I'm sure, has been spurred on by evangelical groups from the United States. I don't know that I have a good answer for that.
Yeah.
I think trying to impose some kind of cookie-cutter uniform idea of what activism and what LGBTQ rights should look like within, translating what it looks like in the United States to what it may look like in Uganda or Nigeria or wherever, that's not going to work. I think it's really important to, as I've already said, like help people create a movement that works within the context they're working in, and meet people where they're at, meet the governments where they're at. It's
Denise,
going to be a slow process.
Thank you very much for chiming in. I really appreciate it. Kondoba in Manhattan, originally from Kenya. You're on WNYC. Thank you for calling.
Yes, this is Kondoba. My family been over here for a little while. However, through some study, we learned that this homosexuality is a foreign activities and behavior prior to colonialism. So a little bit of false information, it seems like it's been released. This is a new phenomenon post-colonialism. And if you would have did a wider survey throughout the very of Africa, and even Kenya, you would get a whole different response. There's so many people who really reject this homosexuality. But you go to the people who are along with this here. So there's so many of us that we don't want the President Obama to come give no speech, because we already know the devastation that this have done, and this is not a lifestyle that we really want. This is a minority that's been seeping into these various diaspora of Kenya and Africa, and they have been given the loudspeaker, and the rest of us, our voices are not heard.
And Kondoba, you know that just about everybody listening in New York right now is thinking, no, he's wrong on the facts. There was always homosexuality in every society. It's a few percent of the population in, humanity. And so you would be wrong on the facts when you say it's a post-colonial import. What do you think about that?
Well, I would say that they've been misinformed also. This is what I'm saying. So, I mean, how can you populate a whole continent if everybody's, if the majority is homosexual? You see the mathematics,
right?
Doesn't work.
But, of course, nobody's saying the majority is going to be homosexual and stop having babies. It's just let those few percent, whatever it is, who are, have their rights and have it not be against the law for them to have sex or attend weddings or maybe get married themselves. How does it hurt you?
All we're just saying is that this is a new phenomenon. This has not been going on through the annals of time in Africa. This is our position. So this has creeped up on many people. We're not castigating, because there's many family members that does it. However, the dispel the myth of this is African culture. No. This is a post-colonial imposition, and so many people have fed into it. So, I mean, you know, we can't help that. But the simple fact that if you interview a wider span of people throughout the diaspora, you're going to get a different because it's simple that you can't have a population if people are homosexual.
If everybody's gay and nobody reproduces. But Kandoba, thank you very much for your call. I really appreciate you calling in. And Gregory, I guess is very representative of very many people in the countries you did this reporting from.
Not only that, I hear in Kandobo's statements itself another Western export of homophobia. I mean, that itself, all the statements that he said come from, I'm not saying that Kandobo is copying anybody, but those ideas were directly exported by a core group of anti-gay extremists. Scott Lively is one of the foremost folks on that. He's traveled to Russia. He's traveled to Uganda. He was very much part of the writing of that Ugandan bill. He traveled to Moldova just to make sure an anti-discrimination statute didn't pass there. So when we look at the backlash, we have to also, I mean, it's not fair to blame the backlash solely on this battle, I think, between traditional culture and universal human rights, because there are many forces in the room, including nationalists and opportunistic African politicians, as well as a very, very committed group in America who wants to export the culture wars, who are spreading this message and using that spin.
Gregory Warner, NPR's East Africa correspondent, part of the Nation Engage series, as we talk about the conflict, the tension between universal human rights and letting different countries' cultures be what they are. Let's do one more before we turn the page and even broaden the question further. Kwame in the Bronx, originally from Ghana, right, Kwame?
Yes.
Thanks so much for calling.
Hi, thank you, Brian. Thanks for picking up my call.
What do you want to say?
Well, I want to find out why it has become so much important for Western journalists and Western politicians in general to try to push a policy agenda in various parts of Africa, particularly on this issue. One thing that throughout this conversation, one thing that I've realized is a deep disregard for the African culture and try to implant a culture from America into a place that is not accepting it. What people do not understand is these are people who do not accept this type of behavior. The culture does not accept it in general. The culture does not accept it. If we take Christianity that was imported into Africa, the basic tenets of Christianity does not accept homosexuality. Then you take the African religion, which does not give any chance of homosexuality. So this is what I'll say. Why don't we give it a chance? You made reference to the conversation between President Obama and President Uhuru Kenyatta. I think the response that President Kenyatta gave was right on point. It is not a time for us to concentrate on homosexuality. Why don't you allow us to evolve to a stage that we can inculcate what you think is right for you? If we think it's right for us, maybe we might take it up. How long did it take homosexuality to be accepted in America? I do not know when the struggle began, but I know it just got legalized.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. Why would you want us to take something just less than a year after you have legalized?
I mean, I think you make a great point. I would disagree that this culture comes from America. I think there's a lot of evidence that there's indigenous LGBT culture in Africa. But here's where I want to echo your point. Is that journalists end up focusing on this issue, diplomats end up focusing on this issue, and this is something actually American activists wrestle with that I've spoken to. They say, you know, we want to bring attention to this issue, but unfortunately, Well, for various reasons, it's easier to get Americans' attention about LGBT issues in Africa than it is about almost any other issue. And, of course, Africans are dealing with many issues. So the problem is that when there's so much attention or disproportionately seeming attention to this LGBT issues, that translates in Africa as, wow, America is pushing a gay agenda, and that can just fall right on the heads of African activists who are right in the line of fire.
So, Kwame, let me broaden it with you even a little more and ask you kind of an abstract question. Do you, if you've ever thought of this, think there is anything such as a set of universal human rights, or should be?
Well, just to let you know, I'm a student of that field, so is there any...
Sorry, a student of what did you say?
I'm a student of international relations.
Oh, so, and that field, uh-huh.
Yeah, so I have a broader interest. Now, this is what I'll tell you. Is there a universal ethic or code or human rights? I would say theoretically, no. In practice, we are trying to evolve to institute something of the sort. Then we talk of the various United Nations Human Rights Acts. Is everybody implementing it to the latter? I would say no, not even America. So if you decide to cherry pick and do what you think is good for you, somebody else is also going to cherry pick and do what they think is right for them.
Right.
At the end of the day, we both need to give ourselves the chance to evolve into a unity of implementing policy.
I understand what you're saying about different societies cherry-picking rights to focus on because it seems to benefit themselves. Do you think there is or should be, I mean, of course, the UN has this, a Universal Declaration of Human Rights. We could make a list of, you know, maybe it starts with freedom of speech or freedom from being imprisoned without charge and trial. And then it's come to the point, certainly in this country, where it includes right to your private sexual behavior and beyond. You think that's a worthy goal or an unworthy goal for humanity, for activists to try to strive to broaden, you know, to help establish the fact at all of a universal set of human rights, and we can debate what should be included, and then try to spread them around the world for the sake of everybody?
Sure, Brian, I do agree, and I think there should be. I think every human being deserves to be respected for who they are and what they want to be. This is where most Africans diverge on the point. When they are being asked to support certain behaviors, that is the point of contention, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, there should be universal human rights. I should respect the next person irrespective of who they are. And I'll give you my personal take on this very issue. I do not support gay marriage. However, it is not my responsibility to tell somebody not to be with who they want to be with. But you cannot force me to support him or her. I would not make laws, or I would not tell them what to do. Mm-hmm. That is their choice. If a woman decides to be with a woman, that's fine with them. But
right.
Do not force me to behave differently towards them.
You don't support the notion of homosexual relations, but you also don't support a government telling people that they can't do it. Do I hear you right?
No, I do not support the notion of homosexuality, but I do not support the government telling me to accept them.
To accept them. Oh, you don't accept. Aha. So you do accept your right to have the government impose your disapproval on them.
Yeah. No, I don't expect the government to tell me to disapprove them. You're not getting my point.
No, I'm saying the opposite. You expect the government to take your disapproval and codify it into law against others so they cannot engage in their own homosexual relations.
No, I'm not saying that government should codify my disapproval.
Okay.
What I'm saying is the government should not tell me to approve of them.
To how you should feel. Kwame, thank you so much. We really appreciate you engaging as much as you did.
I mean, just listening to this, you know, I have to add the example of South Africa, because it's so important to mention that South Africa was the first country in the world to have a constitutional amendment that respected the rights or the anti-discrimination against lesbians and gays, and I think the fifth country in the world to have a same-sex marriage act 10 years before ours. And what a different story it would be if on the African continent that South Africa was the beacon or was the example of what Africa could be, and it wouldn't have to be this Western versus the African continent and this kind of false thing about traditional values. And what's interesting about the South African example is that it's a post-apartheid move. It was an anti-colonial move. And same thing in Rwanda. Rwanda post-genocide also passed an anti-discrimination law because they saw what had happened with groups fighting each other. So these are African stories that unfortunately don't get told because those countries stay silent when they think that they're going to be tagged as Western.
So let's continue after a break and broaden the conversation beyond East Africa and beyond LGBT issues. Listeners, or beyond, we weren't just talking about East Africa. We started there and broadened it to various African countries. But beyond Africa and LGBT issues, listeners, as NPR explores U.S. involvement around the world in the series A Nation Engaged, anyone can call in and tell us how you think the United States should be engaged around the world in general, let's say other than for our own economic or national security interests. 212-433-WNYC. Should we be pushing the idea of universal standards of human rights? This is a dilemma for progressives, right? Progressives embrace the idea of universal human rights, but also embrace the idea of respect for diversity and culture around the world and of not imposing American hegemony. So how do you resolve that dilemma for yourself if you thought about this? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. As we continue with NPR's East Africa correspondent who's been thinking about this, Gregory Warner. Stay with us. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and we continue with NPR East Africa correspondent Gregory Warner, taking part in the NPR series A Nation Engaged. Tell us, listeners, how you think the United States should be engaged around the world in general, other than for our own economic or national security interests, and this dilemma between promoting the idea of universal sets of human rights and allowing, encouraging, respecting cultural diversity. Where is that line? And we spent so much time, I'll just tell you from the behind-the-scenes standpoint, on part one with those great callers that we had, that part two is going to be very short. But on the general principle, Gregory,
sure.
I gather you want to make the point from your East Africa reporting that these questions come up in so many more realms than just gay rights.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, Ethiopia is a great example because we all saw the marathoner that crossed the finish line and put out the protest sign of the Oromo protest. And this was a sign that that this marathoner supported the protest that was going on in Ethiopia. Ethiopia is a great example of the other kind of engagement we have in Africa, which is a very quiet diplomacy. In Ethiopia, we've been very supportive of the ruling regime, despite many critics about the human rights record of that regime, and a sense that, no, the best way to convince Ethiopia, to push Ethiopia's human rights, is actually not to mention, not to humiliate the country, not to get into exactly the conversation we've been getting into with this America versus Africa about what a country should be, respect their autonomy, and try to work behind the scenes. Now, many people say that's not working either, so there's no simple solution.
Dennis in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Dennis.
Hi. Even if America should not push any, of its own values or civil rights things in other countries, they definitely shouldn't mess it up. America is always a beacon of freedom looked at around the world. All the prisoners sitting in prisons around the world look at America and say there's one place in the world that stands for freedom. When Obama shakes the hand of the Castro murderers, the prisoners sitting in those prisons that want to go through the international underground railroad you know, they get an extra beating for that. And that should never happen. For his own personal gain, that he thinks he's going to have a legacy, he sold out all the prisoners sitting in Cuba.
Well, he saw, from his perspective, doing more good for more people by going the way that he did. But do you think that has any overtones? Is that heard in Africa, where you've been reporting from, the president of the United States shaking the hand of somebody who is a dictator, and, you know, and that having any kind of ramifications?
Oh, yes, absolutely. It's a huge. I mean, this American president is watched very, very carefully in Africa, in part because of his African roots, and it's a. I mean, just to use the example of Ethiopia, you know, there was a small phrase in the president's speech when he visited Ethiopia. That was just after his Kenya trip. He said, "This is an elected government." Just two words, and that legitimacy was absolutely the topic of so much debate and heartbreak, I think, by a lot of activists who felt that that's literally a shaking of hands of a dictator. So, absolutely, it's watched carefully.
Franny and Cranford, you're on WNYC. Hi, Franny.
Hi, how are you? I love your show.
Thank you.
And I'm in the car all the time, so I listen to it. I just wanted to say, like, I really agreed with that other caller about the guy from Ghana, about how we really shouldn't be imposing what we think can work here to countries where we don't really live. I feel like in Africa especially, there are some basic rights that aren't being met. You know, people are starving. I just read an article that you guys posted about Nigeria, how people, you know, they have to bring little babies to feeding centers. To me, I feel like we should be helping them with more basic things than, like, food, shelter, water, and health care.
How about basic women's rights? The right not to be, I don't know, a possession of your husband, or female genital mutilation.
I agree with you completely. When I traveled to South Africa when I was younger, and these kids put this play on, and the play was about, like, how, you know, to not, you know, to deal with, like, when somebody comes on to you that, like, shouldn't be coming on to you, kind of thing. And it was incredibly eye-opening. And I feel like those kinds of things are so basic. Like, if women and human beings aren't treated, you know, as humans first, you're right.
Yeah.
Women are sometimes looked at as property there.
So which takes precedence for you, the non-interference directive or the, you know, free women from oppression directive?
I mean, I feel like by nature of who our country is, when we do things, we affect what goes on in Africa anyway. I was there when Bush was president, and there was a lot less money coming in for AIDS and women's rights because he was more conservative. And so I feel like by nature of who we are, we affect them. I feel like, you know, women's basic rights and children's basic rights of eating and being humans are paramount. I get that LGBT things are very important. I really, really do. And I'm not saying I don't think that they are. But if people can't eat and if people don't have shelter, then, and if people don't feel safe, then I think, you know, I think those are the things that need to be focused on first.
Franny, thank you very much. One more. Chris in Hackensack. You're on WNYC. Hi, Chris.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I just want to echo the young lady who just spoke and the other gentleman. Some of the same situations happen in the Caribbean that you have to, where the former colonial countries and even America, if they're going to assist you, give you any sort of financial aid, first thing they say is you need to get rid of the make homosexuality legal and stuff like that. And you have to understand, like, they're holding the money back unless you do this. And you, like, you know, and then that sort of stuff makes people angry, because I can't speak for Africa because I'm not from Africa. I'm from the Caribbean. But there is nobody in the Caribbean. There's no country you could point to the Caribbean and say that homosexuals are arrested and put in prison. Yes, it's illegal, but it's not something that is actively, you know, people are being arrested on a daily basis.
And you're saying the French and the British or whoever the former colonial powers were over different Caribbean countries exert that influence still for aid.
That's right. And now you're holding back aid for the benefit of people. So then you try to wonder, people trying to wonder, wait, what are you really, you know, what's really important here?
And on other things too, as far as you know, other things that are considered standards of human rights, Chris, if you know.
Was that you said?
On other things too, on other kinds of freedoms?
No. Well, that's the only, all basically in the Caribbean, everything else is kind of as in the West. It's just this part that's not, you know, there's no holding back of women and, you know.
Yeah, there's not the same other issues. Chris, thank you very much. We're so over time. But give us a last thought, Gregory. I see you're bursting over here.
Sorry, I just need to kind of counter this Africans are starving thing. I mean, I feel like I speak for most of the continent when they say that story in Nigeria. Yes, Africans are starving there because Boko Haram, an Islamist extremist group, was in charge and not feeding anybody. But generally, the whole 90s perception of Africa is really not the story of Africa today. In fact, this LGBT issues actually come from the speedy economic growth and the urbanization of Africa. It's a continent in change. I will just say one more thing, though, in terms of interfering in other countries. There's a new movement now next month in Springfield, Massachusetts. A group of Ugandan activists are suing a sort of professional American homophobe named Scott Lively. I mentioned him earlier. And this is the first ever suit to kind of take on American extremist homophobes in America. And it's a very different strategy than, say, trying to, you know, interfere in another country. It's trying to deal with an export that we're sending.
NPR East Africa correspondent Gregory Warner. And thanks to all of you for your calls. And, of course, keep listening to the station for more in NPR's A Nation Engaged series. Gregory, thanks for coming in.
Thanks, Brian. It's great to be here.
When there's significant change, and I feel like that flag represents what it's supposed to represent, and this country is representing people the way that it's supposed to, I'll stand.
That, as many of you know, was NFL quarterback Colin Kaepernick on not standing for the national anthem before his team's preseason games this summer. And we begin today with that and with a question. What do the American flag and the Star Spangled Banner mean to you? And what does it mean to you when someone refuses to stand for the national anthem? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. I ask because I think it means different things to Kaepernick than it does to his critics. No one seemed to take notice the first few times Kaepernick sat, but over the weekend someone did and asked him about it, and Kaepernick said it was a protest over ongoing oppression in this country.
There's a lot of things that need to change. One specifically is police brutality. There's people being murdered unjustly and not being held accountable. Cops are getting paid leave for killing people. That's not right. That's not right by anyone's standards.
It's such a mild protest, really, not standing. He didn't call a news conference or issue a press release or announce that he wasn't going to stand to draw attention to himself and his political views. He didn't get in anybody's face. He just quietly sat on the bench during the song and then went about his business on the field until the media started asking questions after preseason game number 3 last week. The most surprising thing to me about his comments was how he specifically called for more training for police officers.
There's things we can do to, you know, hold them more accountable, make those standards higher. You have people that practice law and are lawyers and go to school for 8 years, but you can become a cop in 6 months and don't have to have the same amount of training as a cosmetologist. That's insane. I mean, someone that's holding a curling iron has more education and more training than people that have a gun and are going out on the street to protect us.
So that was interesting. Calling for more training for police officers relative to cosmetologists. It isn't exactly the Communist Manifesto, right? But predictably, Kaepernick has been getting waves of criticism and waves of support since this came to light. You can call in and take a side if you like. But for this show, I'm not so interested in Kaepernick good versus Kaepernick bad which can be predictable and boring. I'm more interested in what do the American flag and the Star Spangled Banner mean to you? What does it have to do with sporting events? And what does it mean to you when someone refuses to stand for the national anthem? Also, anyone in law enforcement want to call in and talk about how much training you think new officers need? Does Kaepernick have a point about that? How about anyone in cosmetology? Do you need more training than a cop? 212-433-WNYC, but seriously, anyone in law enforcement, maybe you want to address that specific point. How much training is needed compared to what's typical for police forces today? But besides the thing about police officer training, what I find interesting about Kaepernick and his critics, and this is really the heart of the question that I'm asking, is how they're speaking about two entirely different subjects. Kaepernick hears the anthem, and he thinks about the State of the Union as a whole. He's sitting because to him, the country as a whole is imperfect enough that cops are unjustifiably killing people and getting away with it. His critics hear the anthem, and what they think about, apparently, is Americans who got killed in a war. Kaepernick didn't say anything against soldiers or veterans or U.S. foreign policy. He's talking about domestic civil rights and police-community relations. But listen to Buffalo Bills coach and former Jets coach Rex Ryan.
The opportunity that we have to play a great game is through the, you know, the men and women that are serve our country, and I think that's an opportunity right there just to show respect. And I think that's why when you see our team, every one of us are on that line.
So that's Ryan, and listen to NFL player Alex Boone, who was a teammate of Kaepernick's for 3 years, on the same note.
That flag gives you the right to do whatever you want. But at the same time, you have to show some respect, especially in this position that we're in, where we're playing a game for a living. And, you know, it's almost like disrespectful to, you know, you see all these pictures of these veterans that have no legs and they're standing up in their wheelchair. You know, and I had a brother that served and he lost friends, and I know how much it means to him. And it's just, it's shameful.
So for both of them, it's about the veterans and it's about the war dead. You know, Jake Tapper from CNN tweeted a critical response from a Gold Star mom who wrote that, quote, "My son's body lay in a street after an IED blew up the vehicle he was fighting in. He died protecting the ideals of the flag you refuse to respect," unquote, from that Gold Star mom. And that got retweeted 12,000 times. And that's the disconnect that I find interesting. I don't see the mom's name in the tweet, or I'd say it to honor her family, but with the ultimate respect to the Gold Star mom and her family's ultimate sacrifice, she and Colin Kaepernick, Rex Ryan and Colin Kaepernick, see the flag and hear the national anthem and think about different things. The mom says her son died protecting the ideals of the flag you refuse to respect. Kaepernick thinks he is respecting those ideals precisely by calling out the state, country, for failing to live up to them. They could actually find a lot of common ground on the ideals, perhaps. But to Kaepernick's critics, somehow sitting during the anthem is spitting on our war dead rather than making the social critique that he's making. Based on his statements, he had no intent to spit on the war dead. It wasn't even one of the issues he was thinking about. And once he saw what the response to his sitting for the national anthem was, he addressed that issue.
You know, I have great respect for men and women that have fought for this country. I have family. I have friends that have gone and fought for this country. And they fight for freedom. They fight for the people. They fight for liberty and justice for everyone. And that's not happening. I've seen videos. I've seen circumstances where men and women that have been in the military have come back and been treated unjustly by the country they fought for and have been murdered by the country they fought for on our land. That's not right.
His critique is domestic. So, listeners, what do the American flag and the Star Spangled Banner mean to you? And what does it mean to you when someone refuses to stand for the national anthem? 212-433-WNYC. One other element is that the critics of Kaepernick I've seen in the media tend to be white. So for yourself, listeners, do you think your racial background or the history of race in America informs how you see the flag, what you're thinking about when you hear the national anthem? things like that. And while your calls are coming in, we'll talk to Morgan Jenkins, who has an article in Rolling Stone now called What Colin Kaepernick's National Anthem Protest Tells Us About America. Morgan, thanks so much for doing this. Welcome to WNYC.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
And I see you point out that while black men make up only 6% of the U.S. population, they comprise a staggering 70% of NFL rosters. Do you think that's important context for discussing Kaepernick sitting?
Absolutely. I think we need to think about disproportionate amounts of power here. So you're in the NFL and you're watching all of these black men play in football. But yet, as I say in my article, a lot of them don't even occupy managerial roles. There are no African-American majority owners of any NFL teams. There are no vice presidents or CEOs. And I think that's what I think Colin is mindful of, all of these systemic inequalities that are happening both on the field and outside of it. And I think it's incredibly important.
And you point out that the NFL fan base is 83% white. And
yes.
64% male. I'll add mm-hmm. that's why Donald Trump doesn't want the presidential debates on TV opposite football games. He wants he wants that potentially friendly audience. But you publish those stats. So how do you see the white fan base's relationship to the black players in racial terms, if you do?
So when I think about football in terms of like the racial background, it just seems like black men are seen virtually for entertainment, and that's it. So you're watching football and you're seeing majority African-American males run and tackle and throw each other and show all of this immense aggression and strength on the field. And that's okay there because it's contained. It's within a certain time frame and it's a game. But when they start to talk about the violence that they feel as black men inhabiting those bodies outside of the field, whether being targeted by the police, whether experiencing racism both overtly and covertly, then that's all of a sudden a problem because they're not entertainment anymore. And you have to remind yourself that they're not just NFL players. They are also human beings, black males in America. And I don't know if people really want – I don't know if some people are that comfortable with seeing that complexity and identity.
Do you think the relationship with – sports with mostly white players is different, like hockey or, you know, tennis and golf have very few blacks. Baseball has very few blacks.
Right.
And if players – do you think largely white audiences see those players differently? Like if a white player stood up and said something on a hockey rink, that it would be received differently?
It might. I think – when I think about Colin and his political statement, I'm also thinking about – many other black NFL players who have done something that was outside the norm of their behavior, that being respectable, being very modest in tone. For instance, if you think about Marshawn Lynch, when he did not want to do any interviews and he went to the interview and he said, I'm just here so I don't get fired. Or when you saw Richard Sherman, when he was going against Crabtree and he was very, very passionate about it and people were really upset about it. It was like, well, all this adrenaline's pumping and he's on the field and he's celebrating a victory. How did you not expect for this to sort of pour over into who he really is? And so do I think that we would perhaps esteem white hockey players differently in terms of their aggression vis-a-vis black men's aggression? Absolutely. And that's an historical fact.
And you bring in your article the history of Muhammad Ali's Vietnam War protest, the Tommy Smith and John Carlos Black Power mm-hmm. salute at the 68 Olympics, some WNBA players recently
right.
wearing Black Lives Matter T-shirts. LeBron James wore an I Can't Breathe T-shirt and mm-hmm. came out in hoodies. So there's a historical context for Kaepernick as you see it.
Absolutely, because Muhammad Ali, in his time, when he decided that he was not going to fight in the Vietnam War, he was criticized by both black and white people for disrespecting the flag, disrespecting the nation's creed, bringing down the morale of African Americans who are fighting abroad. And so it makes me wonder if now we look at Colin, who right now, there are a lot of people who are condemning him, both white and black people as well. And I'm wondering, many decades later, are we going to say that, are we going to revere him for what we're now condemning him for? I mean, it remains to be seen.
It is funny that history tends to look back more fondly on many civil rights protests that
right.
the present treats more harshly at the time. And,
mm-hmm.
of course, Ali, case in point, those other ones, case in point, too. Do you
right.
think... the answer to my call-in question about what the flag and the anthem mean to people tends in general to break differently in any way along racial lines?
Absolutely. I mean, growing up, I never heard of any polarizing opinions about the flag, the national anthem, or even Independence Day celebrations from anyone who was not from a marginalized background. So what I mean by that, it was always Black people, people identify as Latinx background, those who are a part of the LGBT community. Those are the ones who I usually hear having these polarizing issues. I've never heard of anyone who saw the other side of it by saying, you know what, I don't know if it really stands for what it stands for all people. I've never heard that from someone who was white. And that's just my observation. That's just my experience.
How about for you, before we bring in some callers? What are the American flag and the Star Spangled Banner mean to you, and what does it mean to you when someone refuses to stand for the national anthem?
Okay, so ideally and theoretically, I believe in the American flag. I believe in America's greatness. But given the political climate that we're in right now, given all of the Black Lives Matter movements that are, you know, expanding both domestically and internationally, it's hard for me to look at the flag with the same reverence as maybe someone who is not of the same racial background as me. So if I saw someone who was not standing for the national anthem like Colin, my first, just thinking about it, I would immediately think that person is a person of color or someone of a marginalized background. And if he or she decided not to do that, then I would say I could understand. I wouldn't feel confused. Now, if I saw a white person that did not stand for the national anthem, I'd be like, I wonder why. That would be a lot more enigmatic to me from my reference point.
Mm-hmm. Given history.
Absolutely.
So let's take some calls. My guest is Morgan Jenkins, who has an article in Rolling Stone now called What Colin Kaepernick's National Anthem Protest Tells Us About America. My question to all of you, what do the American flag and the Star Spangled Banner mean to you, and what does it mean to you when someone refuses to stand for the national anthem, as 49ers quarterback Colin Kaepernick has been doing? Is this all about the military to you? Is that really the first thing that you think of, the only thing that you think of when you're hearing the national anthem or if somebody's protesting during the national anthem? Deborah in Bed-Stuy, you're on WNYC. Hey, Deborah, thanks for calling.
Hi, it's Deborah. And I am a Vietnam-era veteran, but I went into the military as the daughter of a lifer, so I knew what I was getting into, mm-hmm. and I had a specific purpose of getting education funds. So I stood and did what I needed to do, made the pledge. But I hadn't done that with that exception since before I graduated from high school, which was in 1970, I graduated.
Why, in your case?
Because in my experience as an African-American woman and my understanding in depth of the history of this country, I'm not talking about that tap they teach in the books, but the real history of what actually happened to people here, I don't find that lives up to the ideals of what the flag and our Constitution and Bill of Rights stand for. And maybe it's because you kind of, when you start to get into your teens and you start to define for yourself what matters and who you are and what's important, I looked around and remember this was when all the revolutions were taking place in the cities. I looked around and I had people, white people, asking me, a 13-year-old, you know, like, why are your people acting this way? And I'm like, what? Did they not take any history courses and know about the riots in New York City that were bigger than the ones in the 1860s, that were bigger than the ones in the 1960s?
The mostly white draft riots.
You know, that's the history that I'm talking about.
Deborah, I'm going to leave it there and get some other folks on, but thank you for starting us off. Morgan, do I hear you trying to get in there?
Yeah, I'm actually blown away. I mean, just by hearing this other perspective, because I mean, sometimes even when we discuss these opinions about the flag and what it stands for, even in the African-American opinion, it can be an intergenerational difference, if you know what I'm saying. Mm-hmm. My stepfather, he's also a veteran, and he was in Desert Storm. He passed, sadly, but he had a lot of reverence for what America represents. But we would always get into topics about race, and it never felt like he was so staunch in support for America that he couldn't understand. Also, as a man who was born in the 1950s, a man who was also, you know, educated at Harvard, when he would go somewhere, someone would snap his fingers and call him boy. So it's like there's this cognitive dissonance that is going on when it's like you want to have respect for the American ideal, but as a marginalized person, as a person who is systemically oppressed, what does that look like in your day-to-day life? And I think that is what Colin was trying to touch upon.
Karen in West Milford, you're on WNYC. Hi, Karen.
Hi.
Go ahead.
Yes, I think not standing for the flags on national television in sports event, it could. I think there's a time and place for everything, and I think that could send mixed messages. And, you know, just thinking about the children in our country and people watching that, I don't know if everyone understood it. I guess they sort of did, but my feeling of standing up for the American flag and, you know, saying the Pledge of Allegiance in school every day, it's for the people that fight for our country. It's for the people that protect us. It allows us the freedoms that we have today. I was brought up to respect the people that defend us and make the country what we are. Nowhere is perfect. I mean, nowhere. But I think where we are living in this country is the best place in the world you possibly can live. And I just think there's a time and a place for everything. And doing that, sending that message to the young children in our country, I don't think it was the right thing to do. There was a place and time for that.
He might argue,
I don't think that was right.
He might argue that starting these kinds of conversations in front of kids about justice in America is exactly what he wants to do and exactly what he thinks would be productive. And rather than just soiling something, or
right.
You know, what is the danger to the kids in having this conversation start in front of them, as you see it, Karen?
Yes, and I'm a mother of a six-year-old, so you know, I'm trying to hide her from the media and television and everything that's going on and the terrorism and everything else.
Yes.
I just think that we have to stand together and stick together, and I was just very, very appalled. First time I ever called the radio station, so.
And I really appreciate it, and I hope it won't be the last time. But what are they in the same? Why are they in the same category for you? Like protecting them from your kids, from carnage, in terrorism. Why is that in the same category as protecting them, or why is this in the same category as that? Protecting them from Kaepernick sitting and that kind of protest and the conversation that might start.
I just think that. For me, the reason it's in the same category is there's going to be people that are going to risk their lives for our country. There's police officers that risk their lives every day. There's military that, you know, go out to war. And I just feel that, you know, they go hand in hand. And
yeah.
Without the one, you cannot have the other. And my daughter might grow up one day and want to be a police officer, want to be in the military. These children today, they're not going to want to be. Who's going to defend our country? Who's going to defend our families? Nothing's perfect, but not doing that, I think it was the wrong message. If he wanted to make a statement or say something at another point in time, this is a free country, but doing that on national television for everyone to see sends the wrong message.
Karen,
that's my strong opinion.
Thank you so much for calling. We appreciate it, and do call us again. Morgan, you wanted to react?
Yes, definitely. First, I thank the caller for giving me her input on it. I respectfully disagree with that for many reasons. One of the reasons is that I think it's a very slippery slope to try to tell a marginalized person the way in which he or she should react to the powers that may be, the ways in which they feel stigmatized in this country. And I think also the reason why Colin did it on national television is because for the reason that you said, he wanted people to see him. You wanted people, millions of viewers, to see, despite the fact that I have all this money, despite the fact that I have all this prestige, I am still seen as less of a human being to many people. And I'm going to make a statement on it, and you're going to remember it, which is why we're talking about it today. I think in terms of setting a bad example for children, for which children? Because growing up, if I didn't want to stand for the national anthem, if I didn't want to put a hand over my heart, I never had any black woman or man tell me that you better do it. You better do that. Because they understood why that the implications that may be for why I wouldn't do that, because we have these sort of conversations all the time. So it's like being a good role model by being silent. I should be silent about oppression that's happening. I should be silent about inequalities and speaking up about it. I don't know if that's good for the next generation's children, that the next time that someone has an issue with something, that they should be silent about it. They should be more meek and should be more modest. And there's a right way to revolt. There is no right way to revolt. That people protest in many different ways. And I think that is also an issue, to not see the multiplicity of just airing out all of these pent up feelings. And I think when you look at Colin's timeline on Twitter, you see that it's no surprise that he did this. All you see are links about white supremacy, about racial policing, police brutality. It's no surprise. So he was already being vocal. It's just like, I don't understand the sort of concept of like, it was appalling that he did it on TV. Where else would he have done it, where he would have seen so many people react to expose that?
I think Karen's argument is that there's a time and a place. So I'm guessing she would say, yeah, if he wants to tweet out his opinions in that respect on his Twitter feed, great. Standing for the national anthem, if I heard her correctly, is this moment of unity where we are all in it together to respect kind of the fundamental togetherness of what the ideals of this country are even supposed to be. And then, and then go make your political views known in other contexts than that. Did you hear her say she's afraid that nobody's going to grow up and go into the military to defend this country or go to the police force, because we're all going to be so poisoned to think, it's generally a negative thing, this country, rather than it's a generally positive thing and here we all are, or it's a generally mixed thing, but here we all are. And let's have that moment of unity.
Right. And I think the thing is like, there is a time and a place to also talk about fundamental ideals. Ideals are reserved for the textbook. We're talking about real life here. We're talking about the ways in which we are different from each other. And we see that every time we turn on the television, every time we listen to a radio station. And so it's one of those situations where it's like, I don't mind us being together. Ideally, I would love for us to be together. But in order for us to be together, we have to understand each other's differences. We can't try to take a large brush and make it seem like we're all on the same platform, we're all on the same plane. And that also falls into the rhetoric of colorblindness. And so that's also dangerous as well. It's like, okay, let's all be together, but understand our differences first and try not to silence people who have been historically silenced for centuries when they have the moment to speak up about something. And I think also to add on to your point about Twitter, maybe some people think it was appropriate for him to put on Twitter, but also understand that we're seeing two-dimensional people on Twitter. People are two-dimensional there. When you're in front of a television, when you're not standing up for the national anthem, now you're considered a full person now. You're not hiding behind 140 characters and retweets. So it definitely has more of a potent message. That is one of the reasons why we're talking about it today. And we weren't talking about it 2 weeks ago when he was retweeting things about white supremacy.
Linda in Princeton, you're on WNYC. Hi, Linda.
Oh, good morning, Brian, and to your guest. Morgan, is it?
Yes.
Yes. By the way, just really quickly, before I make my main point, in the 1968 Olympic Games, a large part of the protest by the three athletes had to do with the fact that the Federal District Police in Mexico had killed 300-plus students in the immediate past in student protests in Mexico City. That was part of why they did what they did. That was sort of hushed up. The main point I wanted to make was, and I agree with everything Morgan has said and the caller, Deborah, I have a question and then a comment. Why on earth are we playing the national anthem before sporting events? It seems obscene to me, given people's reverence for the flag, that it would be involved in a money-making proposition and obscenely high profits by the owners. Second thing is, I have sat during many town council meetings in Princeton with our 90-year-old former mayor, who was the first black mayor of Princeton, who will not stand for the Pledge of Allegiance at the beginning of these meetings, and I will sit in the back with him and we will hold hands, because I do not believe in being coerced into showing my patriotism. I carry it in my heart.
Linda, thank you very much. Hey, Morgan, have you looked into this? Why do you think we do this at sporting events in the first place? I mean, you know, whether we say it's obscene because it's money-making, well, a lot of things are money-making, but sports is showbiz, basically, right? And we don't militarize or explicitly patriotize movies or plays or concerts, but we do it with ball games, which are, in a way, as far as the spectators are concerned, just another kind of entertainment. Have you ever wondered why?
I haven't. I mean, when the caller asked that question, I was like, oh, wow, why do we do that? I think there's a lot of traditions that we need to unpack and consider. But I think even when we talk about, like, the Olympics, for example, where there was so much patriotism happening, so much support for America and the whole concept of American exceptionalism. It's like, yeah, like, we're America, we're exceptional, we're, you know, we're here, we're big, you know. And I think, I don't know, like, maybe we play the national anthem to just remind people just how great we are. I have no idea. Like,
you know, I saw really one comment on a website from somebody who said it's actually different in that person's view at the Olympics, because in the Olympics, everybody is there explicitly representing their country. But when you're at a sporting event, and in a way, I guess a sporting event is different from other entertainment in that you are representing your place, you know. But then, we should have the San Francisco flag flying over the 49ers games and things like that. We don't do that, but it's, you know, that it's different on the domestic level. What does it actually have to do with revering or respecting the government or the military in the first place? I read, because I was curious about this morning, maybe you'll find this interesting too. I read that the Star Spangled Banner was first played at a sporting event in the seventh inning stretch of a baseball game in 1918, because it was the height of carnage in World War One, and everybody was really becoming aware at that time of just how many thousands of people were being killed in that horrible war, and then somehow it became permanent.
Right.
So that's a little historical background. Let's take one more call. Tommy in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Tommy.
I'm here from Republic, Missouri, visiting, dropping my daughter off at college, and I caught your show today.
I'm so glad you tuned in.
And I wanted to say that
what do tourists do in New York? They listen to the Brian Lehrer Show. Anyway, Tommy, hi.
I am visiting here, like I said. I am Native American. I'm a member of the Cherokee Tribe of Oklahoma. And honestly, there's been no group of people more oppressed than the Cherokee Nation. There is nobody that has gone through more than we did with the Trail of Tears, the reservation system, taking of our lands after the Confederate and Union War, the Civil War. Anyway, that being said, we start every powwow with a flag ceremony. We pledge to the flag.
The American
flag.
We
honor the flag. The reason we do that is the flag stands for more than oppression. It stands for more than the military. It stands for freedoms that came out of the Age of Enlightenment. And one of those freedoms happens to be freedom of speech, which is exactly what this NFL player... Excuse me, I'm out of breath.
That's okay.
I just ran a couple of blocks.
Well, it's both of those things. Go ahead.
Anyway, the First Amendment is what he was exercising. That's what the flag stands for. So even though I personally do not agree with his decision, I think he had every right to do it, and I support his decision.
Yeah, and nobody's saying he doesn't have a First Amendment right to do it. But it's interesting, because it sounds like, Tommy, you feel strongly on both sides of this. That A, he shouldn't be killed in the media too much for doing it, because he's expressing his free speech rights.
And
but at the same time, that you don't actually agree with his expression, with the way he did it.
I don't agree with his expression. I would go about it a different way, because I see the flag as something more than a symbol of oppression, more than a symbol of the military. It stands for so much more. So that is why I personally do not agree with it.
Right.
But overall, I would come down on the First Amendment side and choose that freedom and honor the fact that he did that. And I don't make fun of him because he was just doing what this country was founded for us to do.
Tommy, thanks so much, and good luck to your daughter. You said you brought your daughter to New York to go to college.
Yes,
that's why you're here?
Yes.
Which school?
Columbia.
That's going to be a little different than living in Missouri, right?
Yeah, it's going to be very different than Missouri, but she's going to have the time of her life here, work hard, and learn much.
That's great. Congratulations to you and to her, and I really appreciate you taking a few minutes while you were visiting to call in.
Thank you. I appreciate your show today. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. All right. So, Morgan, I guess we'll leave it there, except maybe to follow up on her last point about the First Amendment. I think, you know, at least there's consensus on that across the political spectrum that he has the constitutional right to do it. People still also have the constitutional right to criticize what he did if they find it worthy of criticism. What do you think is going to happen to him? Do you think that his performance, and for people who don't know the sports context, he was a big star. He's become more of a marginal player. I guess there's a chance that he would get cut from the team anyway before they start the regular season. Do you think this will affect that?
I'm not sure. I think one of the things that I've been doing these past couple of days, I've just been speculating. Like, I wouldn't be surprised if he were to lose endorsements, or if he had potential endorsers, they'd be like, oh, we don't want to touch this guy. I'm worried about when he puts his helmet on and goes out on the field, and when he's about to play, are there going to be other teammates who, or not teammates, the opponents who yell racial slurs at him while he's trying to just play the game? Those are the things that I sort of worry about. In terms of whether or not he's going to be cut, I'm not sure, because we also live in the digital age where a lot of movements have started on the internet and have been started by Black women. And so they're very powerful. And so, especially on Twitter. So it's like, I don't know if there's even a suspicion that he might be cut, then you might see some immense mobilization efforts in the days to come.
You know, it would be really outrageous to me if he was cut for non-football reasons relating to this, while that player on the Giants is retained after his domestic violence, when the team made an official statement that whatever decision they make with him will be purely for football reasons.
Right. And so that's the thing, I think, and I don't want to spend too much time, but I think we need to talk about aggression, where and what it is directed and for what purpose. So when we talk about NFL and its relation to domestic violence, it's very easy to have those conversations because we see how they translate into one another. But when we talk about NFL players, specifically Black NFL players, and the way that they sort of exert their aggression towards white supremacy, towards corrupt police force, and all of a sudden that's a problem because it affects the power of other people, the people who are predominantly in those stands. So it's like, that's what we have to discuss, these all of these sort of intersections that are colliding and crashing with one another.
Well, we could do this all day, but we have other other topics to address. Come back and talk to us again.
Yes, thank you so much for having me.
Morgan Jenkins, who has an article in Rolling Stone now called What Colin Kaepernick's National Anthem Protest Tells Us About America. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. When a New York nursing home is going to close, operators are supposed to give the State Department of Health 90 days notice and submit a detailed plan on how patients will be transferred. The agency has to approve the plan before anyone gets moved out. But according to a three-month investigation by WNYC, that did not happen at two New York City nursing homes, one on the Lower East Side and the other in Bedford-Stuyvesant. Both nursing homes were bought by the same company, the Allure Group, and then sold to real estate companies for profit without giving patients or public officials proper foresight or factual information about the closures. WNYC reporter Cindy Rodriguez tracked down some of the patients and staff at these facilities and is here to play some clips and talk about what she found, including some new details that she's going to break right here. Hey, Cindy, how you doing?
Hi, Brian. I'm good.
So let's just clear up a little background first for people who may not know this story. The Lower East Side Rivington Nursing Home has been in the news a lot this summer, subject to multiple investigations, because last year a development company paid the city to have a deed restriction which required the building to be used only as a healthcare facility lifted before flipping it to a builder of luxury condos for $116 million, netting a $72 million profit. So what can you tell us about the second nursing home on Bedford Avenue in Bedford-Stuyvesant that was also bought by the Allure Group around the same time?
Right. So this was a nursing home on Nostrand Avenue. It typically had around 124 patients in it. And Allure bought it in June of 2015. It was around the same time that it was running Rivington and presumably starting to close Rivington. So these things were sort of almost happening simultaneously, actually. The other nursing home didn't have the deed restriction, so it I guess maybe it flew under the radar a little bit more. But they were both happening around the same time. So both nursing homes were closing at around the same time. In the situation of cabs, some of the families of patients that I spoke to said that Allure took it over in June. By October, they started getting really worried because they started seeing patients getting transferred out, and they didn't know what was happening. So they held a meeting with the administrator to ask, why are people leaving and what is going on? Is this nursing home closing down? At that point, the administrator sort of dismissed rumors that it was closing. But then shortly after, there was a lot of pressure, and one of the family members that I spoke to, whose husband was there, said that she started seeing people just getting transferred out in ambulettes, and pretty soon her husband was getting transferred out as well.
So how close did I come to summarizing your reporting accurately in the intro? Was the owner supposed to notify the state about these closures and how the patients would be transferred, and did they fail to do that?
Yeah, you did a pretty good job of it. Yes, so the closure plan, the State Department of Health is supposed to be notified 90 days in advance, and then there's supposed to be a closure plan. The closure plan is pretty important because you have to remember that a nursing home patient is a pretty fragile patient. People are on ventilators, people have Alzheimer's. They've got some pretty serious medical problems happening. So the closure plan is to ensure that nobody gets hurt in a transfer. So it includes everything from how medical records are going to be stored, how a person's medications and their other necessities will be transferred. And it's sort of a roster of who's there and how they're going to be discharged and how their families are going to be notified. So it's very detailed, and it's there, like I said, to protect the patients. So if all the patients are gone and then it gets filed, well, it becomes sort of meaningless. So that is what happened in the Rivington House situation. In the cab situation, the nursing home was not completely empty when the closure plan was filed. But according to family members, many of them were rushed out before the closure plan was actually put in place.
Why would it be in the owner's interest not to disclose to the state in advance that they were going to do this? Is there something they were trying to avoid in terms of regulation or in terms of meticulous guidelines for the transfer of the patients?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I guess I would say that on the one hand, to have patients there, you're bringing in Medicare and Medicaid money. But on the other hand, when a process is done, it appears to me that for a process to be done in a very meaningful way, it takes time and it has to be done very methodically. So I guess if you are in a rush to turn the building over, then it might be in your best interest to do it quickly and
to have the patients discharged before the closure plan is in place.
So for this piece, you tracked down patients who were in both nursing homes at the time that they were closed. You talked, for example, to Rafaela Rodriguez, whose husband lived at CABS for 8 years. She didn't know anything about the closure at the time, but she recalls here patients being transferred out of the nursing home in droves. Listen.
Then the social worker, they started to work and call all the nurses home to where they can admit her, this person, the other person, just like that. And you can see the ambulance taking the patients to this nursing home, to the other nursing home, to the other nursing home. It was like a nightmare.
It was like a nightmare. Rafaela's husband was transferred to Concord Nursing Home, which is also in Bed-Stuy, and he died shortly after his transfer. Cindy, did she believe that the transfer had anything to do with her husband's death?
You know, she did believe that. She said that he went into a coma because his blood sugar levels reached a dangerous 700, and then he became despondent, and then he got pneumonia, and then he died. So she said that when he was at CABS, his prior nursing home, where he was there 8 years, his blood sugar never reached above, say, 250, and it was always pretty much in control. So when he was transferred, she believes that that resulted in some interruption of his care, and this is what happened. He died after being transferred. So, you know, it's hard to know, really, what the actual cause was. But advocates definitely say that when care is interrupted, you know, consistent care is pretty important, especially when you're dealing with someone that's very ill. And when they get transferred like that and there's an interruption in their care, you know, there's a lot of risk involved in that.
And do I see that you have a new development to break this morning with respect to Rafaela's husband?
Yes. So the Department of Health has said that it would be investigating the alleged inappropriate discharge of Mr. Santiago, as well as the inappropriate discharge of any other patient or family member that comes forward. That includes Sal Sigia, who is the patient that I found that was discharged from Rivington House.
Want to tell us more about that?
Sure. So Sal Sigia was at Rivington House. He was he had AIDS, but his real problem was that he had cancer and he had radiation. It was throat cancer. It affected his esophagus. He aspirates all the time. He has serious pneumonia. He can't eat. He's 6'3" and he weighs 116 pounds. And he was discharged to his fifth floor East Village walk-up, and that was very difficult for him. And he, at times, was crawling up the last bit of stairs in his building. So it was very hard, and his apartment was ultimately found unsafe by visiting nurse services. Eventually, Sal Sigia found a way to be in a elevator building with nurses and therapists that come see him regularly. But that took him 9 months. So that sort of goes back to what I was saying before, is that if you're going to do this appropriately, it takes time to get people into the right place.
Listeners.
Now, the other thing that I would add that is also new is that the Department of Health has said that the company was cited for a failure to file a closure plan in the Rivington House case. And so basically what that means is that their file has been dinged, and going forward, if they were to try to open another nursing home, it would be factored into what's called their character and competence determination. But I would add that there is no fine associated with this type of citation.
Listeners, anybody with a question for WNYC Cindy Rodriguez and this investigative report that took 3 months to flesh out, or maybe anyone who helps us wants to help us still report this story. Maybe you have a loved one or a friend who lived at either of these nursing homes, the Rivington House on the Lower East Side or CABS in Bed-Stuy, when the facilities were closed. Call in and tell us what you know. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. this ding on the company's record, this citation retroactively for failing to file a closure report, part of your reporting was that the state didn't do that originally. So you have kind of two elements to this. One is that the company failed to file the closure report in advance as required. And the other is that when the state found out about it after the fact, they didn't really do anything.
Right, right. Those were both of the things that I've reported. And since then, the Department of Health has come to me and told me about this citation. They are still trying to give me the date that it was issued, so I'm still waiting for that information. But yes, those were sort of the two things that that I was looking at. Why were they allowed to file it after the fact, and then why weren't they cited for it as well?
Were you able to find out whether it's typical for that to happen, that is, for the state to do nothing in a situation like that? Or since it appears already that Rivington House got special treatment by the city, did they also get special treatment by the state?
What I was able to find, which I didn't actually include in the reporting, but was a controller report from, I believe it was 2014. This was a New York State controller report that looked at the way that nursing homes are cited. And sort of the very short version or the conclusion that it came to was that nursing homes do not get cited a lot, and often it takes many years when they do for those citations to actually happen. So that is what I found in regards to that question.
Let's take a call from somebody who I think was one of the sources in your story. This is Susan Duha. Susan, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi, thanks so much, Brian, and kudos to NYC, and hi, Cindy, and thank you so much for the story, and great news on the Department of Health agreeing to investigate those discharges. But I think that there are some other things that are worth looking at as this moves forward. The Allure closures present a real problem because what they did was they discharged people gradually in advance of closing to avoid doing closure plans. And there isn't anything in place that I'm aware of to avoid these creeping closures and creeping conversions to real estate, luxury condos. And I'm wondering whether really the law is sufficient to protect consumers in these cases. Secondarily, yes, there are people who are very fragile and who need continuity of care and need to be protected against transfers made without adequate provision for their care and for, you know, their being able to be close to family and so on. But also, what opportunities were individuals in these nursing facilities given to go home to their own communities and their own homes? That certainly should have been considered, and it would have taken time to craft plans for them to transition to the community in keeping with their civil rights under the Americans with Disabilities Act and the Supreme Court's Olmstead decision. I think these issues deserve consideration by the State Department of Health, by CMS, possibly by the Department of Justice.
And Susan, you're an advocate in this field. You want to remind people what your group is?
Yes, I'm the executive director of Center for Independence of the Disabled in New York, and we're a civil rights organization for people with disabilities in New York City. We help people with disabilities access services and benefits and help them protect their rights.
If there was one policy change that you would hope would come out of all this focus on Rivington House and this whole situation, what might it be?
I would like a whole new look at closure planning and discharge planning to attempt to avoid these stealthy efforts to avoid closure plans and to make the amount of time available post-closure plan more robust and to ensure that people have real plans for transfer and real plans for going home.
Susan, thank you very much for chiming in. We really appreciate it. I'm going to go to Harvey in California, who says he wants to put this in national context. Harvey, you're on WNYC. Hello from New York.
Good morning, Brian. I listen to you all the time from California. I'm a New Yorker. I think it's important to understand that there's a fundamental issue here, and that is that this is not an issue of providing care. This is an issue of flipping real estate. And unfortunately, there's a lot of very unscrupulous people that are in this industry, not because they're doing the right thing for the right reason for the patient. They're doing the right thing for the right reason to be able to capitalize on the property.
Well, that's when people sell the nursing homes, right, as opposed to the people who actually keep and run the nursing homes and keep them up and running, right?
Oh, don't – this is a split-screen issue. There's the people that run the nursing homes, and they're very dedicated, but oftentimes they're owned by real estate investment trusts, and these are all real estate plays. So the real estate investment trust is contracted to have a management company come in and run the nursing home on their behalf. They get paid for every penny that they spend. So they get paid twice. They get paid for managing it, and then they get paid in addition for the sale of the property when it ultimately transpires.
Interesting. Harvey, thank you very much. Harvey says he's a long-term care expert, so was able to put that in some national context. Terry in Queens, you're on WNYC. Hi, Terry.
Hi, Brian. I'm a long-time listener, I think, from the beginning. First-time caller.
Glad you're on.
I want to tell you, I worked at the Village Nursing Home for 7 years very happily. It was a wonderful place. I was a physical therapist there. Village Nursing Home was owned by Village Care of New York. It was sold and is now a condo development, although the Village Nursing Home was formed to be a community nursing home out of great need. Village Care of New York also ran Rivington House. And I would ask this lady to step back this a little bit. And how can Village Care of New York sell these much-needed community organizations to people who flip them? And is there a pattern? And there's just a whole lot of things to be looked at. Village yeah. Care does a lot of good to a lot of people.
Terry, thank you. And this woman is WNYC investigative reporter and urban policy reporter Cindy Rodriguez. Cindy, how about the role of the former owner and runner of the nursing home?
Right. She makes a good point. So, yes, it's true that Village Care, so maybe this is a good point for me to clarify something. So Village Care was the original owner. They wanted to sell. I believe they were having financial problems, and they were an AIDS nursing home, and there wasn't as much of a need. So they were looking to sell that and use that money to invest in there are other nursing homes. But to do that, it's true that they had to empty their nursing home, and they did that. And so when they delivered it to Allure, there were only two patients in there. So that's another closure plan that I have not looked at. And I did try to reach some of those patients, those original patients that were moved out of the place, but I was not able to get in touch with them. It's very hard, you know, it's very hard to reach these patients and their families. You know, nursing homes will say that there are confidentiality laws and they can't give out information. And so it's very, and often people don't have anybody. Often nursing home patients are alone and they don't have anyone advocating for them. So that's another issue as well. But she makes a good point, and I have not looked in thoroughly enough about Village Care to say much more than I have.
Terry, thanks for your call. Let's take one more, because Nancy in Park Slope wants to mention another facility that may be closing around now and put that on our radar screen. So let's see what that's about. Nancy, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Hi. Yes, glad to talk to you. Yes, my friend has been living in the Prospect Park assisted living residence in Brooklyn, and 2.5 years ago, the landlord, with no notice, told everyone that he was closing the place. He's a real estate developer, and we didn't realize that, and everyone had to get out. My friend, there were 130 people there. There's only 5 people left, and including my friend who doesn't want to move. There has been, the Legal Aid Society has taken it on as a case because there was an improper closing plan, and they're also suing the Department of Health about that. And I agree with the man from California that this is an issue of real estate developers acquiring these buildings and then flipping them for profit.
So that seems to be a real estate play in Prospect Park,
yeah,
area.
Grand Army Plaza, yeah. In Park Slope, yeah.
As well. Nancy, thank you very much. Well, Cindy,
right.
There's one to follow up on, maybe, unless you already know about it.
I do know about it, and I've done a little bit of looking into it. But I would say broadly that, yes, you know, there's Cabrini Nursing Home that closed on the Lower East Side as well, and that is now this luxury development. So, yes, there is something to the real estate, to nursing homes being flipped, and nationally as well. I spoke to a national organization that did confirm that this is a real problem nationally.
So, listeners, if you want to hear the full investigative report by our urban policy reporter, Cindy Rodriguez, about the Allure Group's handling of the transfer of patients from Rivington House and cabs in Bedford-Stuyvesant. You can still hear that on our website at WNYC.org. And Cindy, thanks for coming on live and walking us through it. Really, really good reporting. Thank you so much for it.
You're welcome, Brian.
Thanks for listening to Brian Lehrer Weekend. We're back on the radio Monday morning at 10 a.m. In the meantime, follow us on Twitter at Brian Lehrer or Facebook.com/Brian Lehrer WNYC, where there's always a conversation 24/7.